So last week's text, which was Mark 14, 1 through 25, that text ended with Jesus instituting the Lord's Supper, which was him really, as I talked about, as I explained that text, it's really him showing how parts of the Passover meal, the bread and the cups, actually pointed to the work that he is about to accomplish. He refrained from the fourth cup, as I've talked about. In the Passover meal, there were four cups, and they each represented something else. They were hearkening back to the four promises that were given in a couple verses in Exodus 6 to the people before the Exodus. The fourth cup pointed to the consummation of God and his people dwelling together. And he, likely, this is the cup that he said he was not going to drink until he was with everybody in the kingdom. And he likely withheld from this cup because he knew that another cup had to be drunk first. And the theme of the cup that he must drink will continue today as we look at our text, which is the rest of Mark 14, which is 26 to 72. And I point that out because I just like us to see images and themes that continue on and are picked up and reused here. So we're going to see a little bit more of that cup imagery as we go through this text today. The first section of the text is verses 26 to 31. So I'm going to read these verses. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even though all shall fall away, I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly, I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he said emphatically, "If I must die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said the same. As we look to the beginning of these verses in 26, it says, when they sang a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. After the Passover meal, it was traditional and part of the liturgy of the Passover to sing a hymn together. And the hymn that they sung, by the way, would have been the second half of what's known as the Hallel Songs. The Hallel Psalms are Psalm 113 to 118. And if some of that sounds familiar, yeah, we just read it for the scripture reading, but also I've talked about it in the Triumphal Entry. That's where the Hosanna Psalm comes from, is 118. It's part of just the Passover tradition. And they would sing it on their way, on their pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the Passover. So all these psalms would be very fresh on their mind. The Passover meal would begin with this and end with this. So on these psalms that they sung at the end, this would have been the last half of those five chapters that they sung. And they likely would have sung them responsively, with either Jesus or an appointed leader leading the chant, and then they would sing responsively. The last Psalm 118, which was read, like I mentioned, was the Hosanna Psalm that was quoted in the Triumphal Entry. And if you caught these themes as it was being read, it talks about the rejection of the cornerstone and the coming salvation of the Lord. It talks of God rescuing and bringing life instead of death. It talks of one who will come in the name of the Lord, and also talks of the fact that the light of the Lord will shine. It speaks, in short, of God guiding through distress and suffering to glory. And you think of those themes, those would be very appropriate as the yearly reminder on dwelling on the theme of Passover, which was God taking the people out of suffering and bringing them to freedom, bringing them to liberation. And it makes complete sense then that this is one of the songs that the people latched on to sing each year and to close the Passover meal with. And also, what a psalm for Jesus and the disciples to have fresh on their mind as they approach Gethsemane, and what a psalm for Jesus, the Messiah, to whom these verses pointed, to have on his mind as he is about to face what he's already told them multiple times he's about to face. He's about to go through a time of extreme mental, emotional, and physical suffering. And these themes, then, are likely very personal to him as he is singing this and closing with the hymn after the Passover meal with his disciples. On the way, Jesus tells them that they will all desert him, but that they will later be reunited and reconciled. He says, "I will go before you to Galilee." And then after Jesus says this, Peter tells him that even if all the others do so, he would not. Jesus tells Peter that he will deny him three times before the rooster crows twice. When Jesus says that they will all fall away, by the way, the word behind this is scandalizo, which is where we get our word scandalize. It means to shock or to offend. What he's saying then is that they will all be offended by him and, in a sense, seek to distance themselves from him, which is where you get the fleeing. He is arrested. He's going to be arrested. he's going to not fight back, and we'll see how that plays into the reactions. And because of this, the disciples are going to be scandalized and fly away from him. And the ultimate example of this scandalization that's going to happen, this offense that they're going to have, is that Peter will deny expressly three times, which Jesus very sadly looks to him and says, you're going to do that, because Peter so strongly says, no, I won't do it. He's like, well, even if all the other ones do, I won't deny you. And in a sense, he's responding to what Jesus said, you're all going to be offended. And Peter's like, well, even if all the other ones are offended, I won't be offended. And Jesus looks at him and says, actually, you're going to give the most potent example of the offense. The Old Testament quote that Jesus uses comes from Zechariah 13. And if you've caught what I've been saying in the last few weeks, I've mentioned Zechariah a lot. So, by the way, if you want like a complimentary book to go study in addition to listening to the sermons and studying them, maybe go read and use a study Bible or something to work through the book of Zechariah, because there's a lot of Zechariah things that are hinged on what Jesus is saying here. In the context, in Zechariah 12 through 13, God says that the shepherd, is Old Testament imagery for the leader of the king of God's people, says that the shepherd will be struck down and the sheep or the people will be scattered as part of the refining process that will result in the creation of a new people of God. He will pour out his spirit and a fountain will be opened up to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. And Jesus points to this restoration by promising that he will go before them to Galilee, that he is raised, or when he is raised from the dead. So Zechariah, remember, was writing in the time of the rebuilding of the temple. They had just come back from exile. So like, in the immediate context, he is likely not saying things that the people would hear in the way of like, we're talking about all this future stuff. They kind of think he's talking about the stuff now. And he was and wasn't. We've talked about this many times, that prophecy has already, or so many already, or already but not yet. There's so many times where it's like fulfilled in a way then, but also fulfilled even greater later. And this theme of the theme of a leader being struck down, the people scattering, and then that whole process leading to a refining and a new creation of God's people that will then lead to the pouring of the Spirit and a fountain coming that will cleanse and from sin and uncleanness. Like, you can look at all those things, like, well, that kind of applies to the exile and some other times in Israel's history. And Jesus, like, well, yeah, but like, thematically, that's about to happen again, and in an even greater way, with what's about to happen to me in my own ministry. And this restoration that comes afterwards is what he's pointing to with that promise that not only will these things happen, I know you're going to desert me, I know you're going to walk away, but later I will come before you to Galilee and we will be reconciled. Peter, who earlier had confronted Jesus when he had declared the first time about his approaching death, remember when that happened, Jesus, the first time when he predicts his death and resurrection, Peter pulls him aside, the student pulls aside the teacher and says, far be it from you, in effect, like, no, this isn't the way to do this, Rabbi, and Jesus has to say, get behind me, Satan. So like, that's how Peter first responds to Jesus predicting his death, and this same Peter now boldly declares that he will not only not be offended, but that he would even die along with Jesus if needed. But we will quickly find out, though, what Peter meant by this and that he intended to fight, which was not what Jesus had in mind. And then when we read here about before the rooster crows twice, Peter will deny him three times, this is again showing that Peter is going to be the ultimate example of this offense that Jesus prophesied. And despite this bold claim here of loyalty to Jesus, he is going to give the boldest evidence of offense of Jesus. And if you're curious about the rooster crowing twice and how that's going to play later, I'll explain this a little bit more as we get to that portion, but there were typically two times that the rooster crowed. One was in like the middle of the night, and the other one was like basically right before dawn, kind of the typical one you think of with a rooster. So when you read the other gospel accounts, where I think two of them are just like, well, there's one rooster crow, but then Mark here is like, well, there's two. They're not contradicting. It's just they're saying before like the main rooster crow that you think about, the pre-dawn one, before that, you're going to deny three times. So that's just the logistics of that. But the bold claims of Peter and the ending of 31 here, with them all claiming that they will die with Jesus rather than denying him, serves but to heighten their failure and Jesus' feeling of abandonment and denial by his closest friends that he's about to feel. The next section is verses 32 to 42. And I don't remember when I flipped here. I shouldn't have flipped yet. Just a second. Verses 32 to 42. And they went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter, James, and John, and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And again he went away and prayed, saying these same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. When they get to the Gethsemane, Jesus asks the disciples to watch and pray while he prays by himself due to his great distress. He asks them to stay awake, to watch and to pray. Well, sounds a lot like chapter 13, where we were told to watch and pray while we wait for the master. There's some purposeful repetition that's happening here. And the servants were warned in 13 to stay on guard and stay awake. But instead here, what we see of the disciples is that they do the exact opposite. They fall asleep. They're unable to stay awake with him in his hour of need, which is but the beginning of their failures in this night. There are a few biblical theology themes that can be mentioned about Gethsemane, some with more merit than others, depending on like how much of a connection you think things are legitimate to make. What most people pick up on with this Gethsemane imagery is that Gethsemane, in a very real way, was a garden. It was an olive grove. So you have, in effect, here this time of trial, this time of Jesus struggling with this and asking the Father if there's any other way. This comes in a garden. And a lot of people pick up on this and compare Jesus' success when tried to Adam's failure when tried. Adam's choice to eat the fruit brought sin and death, but Christ's choice to drink the cup of God's wrath brings forgiveness and eternal life. So I think there is a very legitimate allusion to see there in the garden imagery. And John, in his gospel, even calls Gethsemane a garden. He actually doesn't use the word Gethsemane, he just says in the garden. Some also pick up on the olive tree imagery and how it symbolizes Israel to see another example of Israel being tested, Jesus himself representing Israel, especially because the name Gethsemane itself actually means oil press. And you have this olive tree, sometimes oil imagery used along with Israel imagery. So it kind of, the name itself can be used to say it hints at a time of trial or pressure against Jesus who represents Israel. And we see that at times, like the 40 days of trying in the wilderness, being typology of the 40 years in the wilderness, and then even in Matthew, out of Egypt, I've called my son. There's a lot of Israel typology that happens in the life of Jesus. So I think that there is also some legitimacy here as well. Some people go even deeper with specific details about the garden and other things like that. But I think for me, those are the two main ones that I think there's a good amount of legitimacy to those biblical themes that are being brought up. But as far as what's happening in the Garden of Gethsemane, not only do we see the loneliness and the abandonment that Jesus is already facing, but we also see the reality and the rawness of his humanity and his understandable struggle that he is facing the night before his death. It is easy to read all of Jesus' predictions and his foretelling of what is about to happen and think that, well, it didn't affect him. He knows he's just going to rise again 3 days later, so like, whatever. But that is to completely strip away the humanity from Jesus of the fact that, yes, even though he knows the plan, even though he knows that he will rise again 3 days later, that does not make anything he's about to face any easier. He knew exactly what was about to happen. He'd been telling his disciples multiple times, in fact, in pretty explicit detail sometimes, what was about to happen. But he desperately asked the Father one more time, if there's any other way, but there wasn't. The cup of God's wrath and the judgment for sin, which is symbolized in many prophetic books, that cup had to be drunk. And God the Father, the plan that the Son willingly agreed to, they knew that if the Son didn't drink it, all of humanity would have to drink it. And there is no hope for us. And when we see this exchange between the Father and the Son, I think in it we need to realize the depth of the humanity that Jesus felt in that moment. I think it is also a conviction and a reminder to us that even the Son praying to the Father had to listen to no. It is easy sometimes to look at verses that talk about, well, ask anything in my name and it'll be granted to you, to view verses like that that talk about the confidence with which we can come to the throne, with which we can come to Christ. And all those things are true. As I've talked about a couple of times, though, the main thing that those verses specifically are talking about is actually just the dramatic change that happened, where before you used to have to go to a temple, you used to have to pray through these ceremonies and through these sacrifices and through the priest. And what was understood is that only like the most holy of men who had these high status of the priesthood, only they had even remotely close to the confidence of semi-confidently approaching God and asking him for things and having a hope that they are heard and blessed. And what Jesus is saying is actually you're all about to be priests. You're all about to have that amount of access. Not that everything you ask will be a yes, but that you can approach to ask with that confidence, that you have that level of access to God that is so dramatically different and better than what was before. And I just wanted to put that out as a reminder there that sometimes it is hard in our life to get a no, but even the Son had to deal with a no from the Father. Jesus then, humbly submitting to the will of the Father, said, "Not what I will, but what you will." And leading his disciples, he said, "Rise, let us get going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And you can read this, "Rise, let us get going," as like, if you don't know the rest of the story, like, oh, he's about to flee because the betrayer is coming. It's actually directly the opposite. He's effectively saying, let's go, let's walk towards. What must happen? So this is a resolution to not only humbly submit, but to go towards purposefully and intentionally go towards the plan of the Father. In the next section, we are going to see the betrayal and the arrest of Christ, and this is seen in verses 43 through 52. "And immediately while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'The one that I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard.' And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, 'Rabbi,' and kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me, but let the scriptures be fulfilled.' And they all left him and fled." While Jesus was speaking, while he was saying, "Rise up, let us go, for the hour has come," while Jesus was speaking, Judas came, leading an armed crowd under the authority of the chief priests, scribes, and elders. Due to the darkness of the night, Jesus had told them that Jesus had given them a signal with which he would identify Jesus to arrest them. So going up to Judas says, "Rabbi," which is a term of respect, and then kisses him, likely in the typical Mideastern fashion of grabbing him on both shoulders and kissing him on both cheeks, which was a sign of affection and respect. But it possibly might even have been a light kiss on the lips, which was a sign in that culture of an even greater act of affection among family and close friends, which being that Jesus and the 12 disciples had a very close relationship, might have even been that. Either way, as one of the 12, as one of Jesus' closest friends, who had been entrusted with the treasurer as the treasurer of their group, Judas betrays Jesus with a fake show of respect and affection. He uses all the cultural signs of saying, "I am loyal to you, I have affection and respect towards you," and he uses them to say, "I am betraying you." When the group seized him, one of the apostles, identified in John as Peter, cut off the ear of one of the servants of the high priest, likely intending to do more harm than that, by the way. We know from the other gospels that Jesus then told Peter to put away his sword and healed the man's ear. And I think what's going on here is Rome may try to bring about their kingdom, their gospel, through military might, but that is not how Jesus came to bring his kingdom. He is showing clearly, once again, that people are not the enemy. We don't bring this kingdom through military expansion. We bring it through the work that I'm about to do. Jesus then asks the crowd why they have come to arrest him at night like he is some nighttime robber, instead of in the day when he was in the temple publicly teaching, since his teaching was what they were arresting him for. But he says, let the scriptures be fulfilled. In this, I believe he's referring to not only Isaiah 52 to 53, the suffering servant, but also to Psalm 22. And both of these texts talk about the mistreatment of the Messiah. He likely also has in mind the many psalms that reference being delivered into the hands of the wicked and being betrayed and deserted. And then all his disciples, including Peter, left and fled, which was a great shame to the teacher to be abandoned by all of his inner disciples during his time of need. In 51 to 52, we also then have a curious side note. It says, a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. We have a curious side note here that only Mark includes, that a young man who was following him was also seized, but shedding his linen cloth, fled away. That this detail is only given in Mark is used by many to argue that this man was John Mark, the author, which is possible. If so, he was protecting his identity as the author and close follower of Jesus, which I've talked about this a couple times. You have to remember that Mark wrote this book at a time of severe persecution, and there are times in the book where he kind of cloaks people's identity in order to protect them as this book is being circulated. There's a chance he's doing that with his own name. There's also a chance that he, being somebody who likely lived in Upper Jerusalem and was kind of in sort of relation to these circles, he was related to a couple of disciples, so he was kind of in and out of a lot of this stuff. He very likely may have been following them to see what was going on here. But either way, this fleeing away here, what he is doing is, if he is presenting himself as a close follower of Jesus, he is also purposefully also including his failure, his fleeing, in this moment too. He is just as cowardly and just as frightened as the other disciples. And then in verses 53 to 65, we're going to see Jesus before the council. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. Yet even about this their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Again the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, no further witness, or what further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. Jesus was led to the house of the high priest, and all the other religious leaders gathered there as well for his trial. And Peter, we read, also followed at a distance and remained in the courtyard with the guards by the fire. This trial, by the way, likely broke many Jewish legal laws of the time. It's a little bit tricky to be super dogmatic about this, though, as the writings we have about the Jewish laws of this period come from a little bit later than this time. But even if they were not written down laws yet, they were very likely legal and ethical principles that were violated here. And there were definitely laws from Deuteronomy that were violated here as well. This, as you read the details of what is going on here with this trial, this is a secret nighttime meeting without advance notice in the home of the high priest rather than the assembly hall of the temple. It should have been dismissed when the testimonies contradicted each other. In fact, under the law of Deuteronomy, not only should the case have been dismissed, but the false witnesses themselves should have been punished instead. None of that happened. The high priest also could not force or pressure Jesus to testify against himself as he does here by twice asking him. It is quite obvious that the religious leaders were more concerned about convicting Jesus of a capital crime than following their own laws, ethics, or precedents. The whole trial is clearly rigged, a clearly rigged procedure to declare Jesus' guilt in a secret way that will not allow the people to riot against the trial. The religious leaders and even the high priest ironically demonstrate that their own corruption, or sorry, the religious leaders and the priest ironically demonstrate their own corruption and guilt as they supposedly seek to uphold the law of God and honor him. This was not justice then. And when similar tactics are used now, when power or money are used to distort justice, silence and ignore victims, and shield the guilty, that is not justice today. When the conviction of being right causes the disregard of law, morality, and ethics, and even just decent human kindness, and the belittling and vilifying of others to pursue an agenda in a way that would quickly be condemned if the other side did what you were doing, that is not justice, and that is not right. Jesus, in the midst of all this corruption, remained silent, just as is spoken of in Isaiah 53. In an attempt to follow even just the bare minimum of the law, they sought two witnesses to agree in their charges against him, but the witnesses contradicted each other. Some claimed that he said, "I will destroy the temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands." But even about this, their testimony didn't wholly agree. This specific charge, by the way, is ironically included in Mark to show that they were right, kind of, as Jesus' life, death, and resurrection and judgment are a replacing of the current temple system, and the fact that this has been a theme in Mark that he's been developing, especially as we talked about in chapters 11 through 13, the connection of him talking about the coming destruction of the temple and him being the cornerstone on which the new temple will be built. And in fact, their inclusion of the phrase "not with hands" is an addition by them that refers to Daniel 2 and the stone that was cut not by human hands that destroyed the great kingdoms of the world and became a mountain that filled the earth. Jesus didn't actually say these words, and none of the apostles or none of the gospels do you have him in this quote they're pulling from. He doesn't say, "I will make the temple not made with hands." They kind of add it in there. But as we discussed in chapter 12, it is actually a valid allusion that they caught from what he was saying in his conversations with the leaders in the temple. So it's not like completely out of left field that they're adding it into what he's saying. It's they're kind of grabbing onto one of the allusions that he would have brought to mind with what he was saying. They were using it as a way to claim that he claimed to be the Messiah or even God himself, as the temple not made with hands is not just from Daniel 2, but it is also a repeated theme in the Old Testament of a future perfect temple made by God himself. So for him to claim these things, in a sense, what they're trying to do is they're trying to pin him on a blasphemy charge. The high priest then asked Jesus if he had any answer to these claims against him, but he remained silent. Jesus' silence not only fulfills Isaiah 53, but it also fits the Jewish model of a martyr showing contempt for a corrupt court. The high priest then directly asks him, "Are you the Christ," meaning the Messiah, "are you the son of the blessed?" Which the blessed, by the way, son of the blessed here, the blessed is a euphemism for God because it's a way of avoiding saying the word God irreverently. So in effect, what his question is, are you the Christ, the son of God? The question is not random, but directly coming from the allusions that we just talked about in these accusations that are being brought against him, which are trying to pin him on claims of being the Messiah. It was understood from the Old Testament that the Messiah would have authority over the temple, being the promised son of David. The high priest is likely using the phrase son of the blessed, which means son of God. He's likely using this phrase to simply emphasize the role of the Messiah being the king or God's son, which is phrases that are used from Psalm 2 and 2 Psalm 7. These texts weren't necessarily understood to teach explicitly that the Messiah was divine. But we'll get into how Jesus kind of turns that on its head here in a second. Here at the climax of Jesus' trial, the titles Christ, which is Messiah, and Son of God are combined for the first time actually since the very first verse, since Mark 1:1. The phrase Son of God, or the Father calling Jesus my beloved Son, has appeared at key places like Jesus' baptism and the Transfiguration, and it'll appear again at his death. And the title Christ or Messiah also appeared at Peter's confession, right before the Transfiguration. So these have been very key phrases here, key titles that have marked key points in the book of Mark. And Jesus uses this question and the combination of these two titles to clear up any ambiguity that people might have had about what exactly he has come to do. He starts with simply saying, I am, which is affirming explicitly that he is claiming to be the Messiah that they're accusing him of. But he also, I think, purposely starts using the divine I am as his answer, as a perfect lead-in to the rest of his answer. He says that he is not just the Messiah, who is the promised future king and son of David, but he also says that he is divine. He says he is the Son of Man from Daniel 7 who comes with the clouds. And I've talked about this in Sunday school more at length, and I've kind of hinted at it in sermons a couple times, but like cloud rider imagery was a huge divinity claim. In the ancient culture, it's used a few times in the Old Testament. It's also used in the New Testament a little bit. And where that comes from is that in the Baal theology, Baal was a cloud rider. It was part of his divine identity. And then in Daniel 7, you have the Son of Man coming on the clouds to the Ancient of Days. And there was a lot of debate about that because that's effectively saying that there's two divine, two people, two persons of God. Because you have the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days, who's obviously divine, but if the Son of Man is riding on clouds, then he's also divine. So Jesus is picking up on that divinity claim from there in the cloud rider imagery. He also is saying, by this allusion to sitting on the right hand of the Father here, he is saying he is also the Lord from Psalm 110, who will sit at the right hand of the Father. And he is also likely hinting at about three verses later in Psalm 110 that he is the promised priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, he does not include this priest language here in his answer, but I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that it would be on his mind and a purposeful allusion that he's bringing up, being that he is talking to a corrupt high priest who is doing a very corrupt trial against him and saying, like, I am the true priest after the order of Melchizedek. He, in short, is claiming, yes, I am the Messiah, and you have grossly misunderstood how that role is going to be fulfilled. It's not just a man, but myself, God the Son, myself. With all these roles in himself, by the way, Jesus ironically stands as a judge of his judges, who are guilty of the very crimes that they're accusing him of, which is mocking God's anointed one. The high priest, though, hearing this bold divine divinity claim and Messiah claim, cries blasphemy, and they all agree and condemn him to death. They spit on him, cover his face, and strike him while mocking him, and give him to the guards to beat him. And then we read in 66 to the end of the chapter 72 of Peter's denial. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also were with the Nazarene Jesus. But he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you mean. And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him, and it began again to say to the bystanders, this man is one of them. But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, certainly you are one of them. You are a Galilean. But he again began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. After Jesus' faithfulness and true witness, we read of Peter's unfaithfulness and false witness. A servant girl says Peter was with Jesus, but he denies it. And a rooster crows the first time, which doesn't seem to have tripped anything in Peter's brain yet. And then he denies twice more, even invoking a strong curse on himself, which is basically saying, let me be cursed if what I am saying is false. And immediately after his third denial, the rooster crowed for a second time to signal the coming of morning. And we read, and Peter remembered how Jesus has said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. The disciples failed three times to stay awake, to watch, and to pray. And now Peter denies Jesus three times. From a bold proclamation of loyalty to an equally bold denial in just a few short hours. Luke adds the detail that after the second rooster crowed and Peter had denied him three times, Jesus turned and looked at Peter. We aren't told the emotion or the facial expressions of that look, but I think we can imagine it. We can imagine their hurt. And we read of Peter's response, that he broke down and wept. There are many passages that evidence Jesus' true humanity, but this is probably one of the most powerful. And it's hard to teach. He, being fully God, also became fully human. He is our compassionate high priest, as we read in Hebrews. And this is not just because in his humanity he was tempted in all the ways that we are, but also because he suffered every kind of pain and loss. He was betrayed. He was abandoned. He was let down by his closest friends. He was denied. He was falsely accused, mocked, and mistreated. And all of this for us. We shouldn't give the disciples too hard of a time, by the way, because they are us. Knowing our weakness, he chose to save us anyway, even though we abandon and deny and forsake him with our choices. And just as he later went back to the disciples and brought forgiveness and reconciliation to them, even giving Peter the opportunity to affirm his faith three times and undo his three denials in a way, so he also meets us in our shame, in our weakness, and in our failure. If we confess our sins, we know he is faithful to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness, for he knows our frame. He is the faithful, suffering servant who willingly drank the cup of God's wrath for us, offering, instead of God's wrath, forgiveness and life instead. So let us go to him in prayer. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. It is an incredibly hard text to work through, to imagine your pain, to imagine that you emptied yourself, that you became as one of us, and not only that, but you suffered all this for us. And this is just the beginning of what you went through on that day. We thank you. We have a debt to you that we can never repay. And we owe our life to you. And I pray that we would come to you desperately, taking advantage of the opportunity that we have to confidently come to you because of the work that you did for us. I thank you that you understand us, that you know our frame, that you know our weakness, and that you know what it is to be tempted and to suffer. I thank you that we have a compassionate high priest that we can come to, and that we can bring our pain and our sorrows to you. And I pray that each day we take advantage of this and that we find strength and hope in you. And I pray all this in your name. Amen.